This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
The current struggle for public sector worker rights in Wisconsin and around the country has galvanized community and worker sentiment and support to an extent not seen since the battle to organize the Memphis City sanitation workers in 1968. This was part of the upsurge of the civil rights movement of the 60s and also of the mass unionization of public sector workers in that decade.
Later on, we proceed down the Jericho Road looking at the Memphis strike, Martin Luther King Jr.'s last campaign, with author Michael Honey. But first,
it's crucial that we draw lessons from the life and struggles led by the Reverend King for civil rights, labor rights, and for all human rights. Today we focus on the Reverend King's last battle, a community labor struggle for the striking African-American sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee in 1968. Later we'll hear from the Reverend King himself in one of his last speeches, but first,
it was at Memphis that King fought his last battle for the black sanitation workers. We talked with Taylor Rogers, who was an active rank-and-file member of the union during that struggle and later, for 20 years, became the president of the local. What was your salary in those days?
About $1.50 an hour.
And did you have any vacation time?
No.
What about sick leave?
No sick leave.
And a grievance procedure?
No grievance procedure.
How were the work assignments of the white sanitation workers different than those of the black workers?
Well, they didn't have any white sanitation workers. The whites was heavy equipment operators. They dealt with the bulldozers and those big cranes and things. You know, it was a whole different ball game for them because on rainy days they still got paid. They would come in and just be there and they would get paid, but they would send us back home and we didn't get any pay.
When you actually went on strike, how was your family affected?
Well, they really wasn't, because of the community and the leadership and the churches and everybody that came together to help those strikers. They provided food for us, and we helped pay our bills and all this kind of stuff.
Was your personal safety ever in question during the strike?
Sometimes, you know, you would get threats, you know, nigger, go back to work, and this kind of thing.
How did you pick up the support of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.?
Through Reverend Lawson, one of the ministers here in Memphis. He contacted Dr. King, you know, and that was Dr. King's thing, was to help poor people. People on the bottom of the ladder, and he contacted Dr. King, and he came in. You know, he was at that time he was planning for the Poor People's March. He just put everything aside to come in and work with the sanitation workers. You know, people had faith and confidence in him. It mobilized the men that the ones that had begun to start to go back to work. When he got involved, that mobilized the men, and all those men that had went back come back out, and you know that helped mobilize this whole thing.
What did the struggle for civil rights and the struggle for workers' rights have in common? What joined the two together then?
Let me try to put it this way. Because it's all the same thing, you know. They were saying our strike was illegal, but all they were saying, segregation and this kind of thing, it all it means that a man is not a man. Whatever you say or however you put it, when it comes down to that, you know, it's just, you know, a man is not a man, and he don't have anything to say about his hours and working conditions.
Wasn't there an injunction that was prohibiting the workers from marching at that time when Martin Luther King came down?
The injunction came about after the first march. It was violent, and Dr. King was determined to come back to Memphis and have a non-violent march, and that's when they was talking about this injunction. The only injunction that we had about going back to work was on the first time that we came out to try to get recognition. And then we had to go back in with that injunction. But the second injunction they were talking about, an injunction to keep from having this second march.
How did the terrible tragedy of the assassination of Martin Luther King on April 4th affect the strikers?
You know, the strikers were sad, but I think that because his death was the cause of the nation getting behind Henry Loeb and making him move off his stand that we couldn't organize.
How did the settlement of the sanitation strike affect the workers and also other workers in the municipal government? Did they organize because of it?
Yes. Yes, they did, yeah. And, you know, we got benefits. I can't just spell out the you know, specifics of it, but I just can't remember that far back. But anyway, we had a decent settlement. At that time, it was just 1,300 sanitation workers that went out. But right after the strike, and after we got recognition, then we organized the school board, the city hospital, the park commission, and all other municipalities.
What do you think that the union movement has done for black workers?
It's done wonderful things. Like I said, you know, we moved up. We got good wages. We got good benefits. And, you know, it always can be better. But we do have good wages and good benefits at this time.
We actually are speaking to you on the national holiday of Martin Luther King's birth.
But,
in reminiscence, is there anything that particularly occurred to you today?
Well, you know, from Dr. King's way of doing things, you can always remember that he was for poor people. He was trying to upgrade poor people. That was just the kind of a person that he was.
We'd like to thank you very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Taylor Rogers, former president of the Memphis Sanitation Workers, and striker in those very early days for recognition of the rights of African-American workers in Memphis.
And now a selection from Dr. King addressing an audience of Memphis sanitation workers during the strike.
All labor has dignity. But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
In an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society. We are tired of walking the streets in search for jobs that do not exist. We are tired of working our hands off and laboring every day and not even making a wage adequate to get the basic necessities of life. So in Memphis, we have begun. We are saying now is the time. Get the word across to everybody in power in this time, in this town, that now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to make an adequate income a reality for all of God's children. Now is the time for City Hall to take a position for that which is just and honest. Now is the time for justice to roll down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. Now is the time. Now let me say a word to those of you who are on strike. You've been out now for a number of days, but don't despair. Nothing worthwhile is gained without sacrifice. The thing for you to do is stay together and say to everybody in this community that you're going to stick it out to the end until every demand is met, and that you're going to say, we ain't going to let nobody turn us around. let it be known everywhere that along with wages and all of the other securities that you are struggling for, you're also struggling for the right to organize and be recognized. We can all get more together than we can apart. We can get more organized together than we can apart. And this is the way we gain power. Power is the ability to achieve purpose. Power is the ability to affect change. And we need power. What is power? Walter Ruther said once that power is the ability of a labor union like UAW to make the most powerful corporation in the world, General Motors, say yes when it wants to say no. That's power. And I want you to stick it out so that you will be able to make Mayor Loeb and others say yes even when they want to say no. Now the other thing is that nothing is gained without pressure. Don't let anybody tell you to go back on the job and paternalistically say, now, you are my men and I'm going to do the right thing for you. Just come on back on the job. Don't go back on the job until the demands are met. Never forget that freedom is not something that is voluntarily given by the oppressor. It is something that must be demanded by the oppressed. Freedom is not some lavish dish that the power structure and the white forces in policy-making positions will voluntarily hand out on a silver platter while the Negro merely furnishes the appetite.
That's right. That's right.
If we are going to get equality, if we are going to get adequate wages, we are going to have to struggle for it. Now, you know what? You may have to escalate the struggle a bit. If they keep refusing and they will not recognize the union and will not agree for the checkoff of the collecting of dues, I tell you what you ought to do, and you're together here enough to do it. In a few days, you ought to get together and just have a general work stoppage in the city of Memphis. And you let that day come. Not a Negro in this city will go to any job downtown. When no Negro in domestic service will go to anybody's house, anybody's kitchen. When black students will not go to anybody's school and black teachers.
I was born by the river in a little tent. And just like that river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long a long time coming, but I know a change is gonna come. Oh, yes, there is. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change is gonna come. Oh, yes, there is. And so I went to my brother, and I said, brother, help me, please.
We are going to race down that Jericho Road with Michael Honey, professor of ethnic, gender, and labor studies at the University of Washington, Tacoma. And we're going to discuss his book, Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign. It's very nice to have you with us, Mike.
Hi, Mimi. Good to be here.
First of all, it's a gorgeous book.
Oh, thank you.
A gorgeous book, a critical book, and you begin to answer a question that is always fundamental to me in an organizing capacity, and that is the explanation of the necessity to have a conjuncture of race and class in order to really advance the interests of the oppressed and exploited. And you pick the Memphis Sanitation Strike, which was the last campaign for the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And one of the things that I want to find out is why Martin Luther King against, because it helps shape, and that's part of what this book is, it helps reshape for many of us, I think, the image and the knowledge of who Martin Luther King really was. What brought him to Memphis against, as I understand it, the advice, indeed over the criticism of many of his lieutenants in the Southern Christian Organizing Committee, etc. They didn't want him to participate in the campaign, an economic campaign of black workers in the Deep South to fight for unionization.
I don't think it's that SCLC didn't want him to participate in a campaign for unionization, because they had actually done that in the past. Mm-hmm. King helped to lead a strike of Scripto workers in Atlanta in, I think it was 1963. But the issue was that King was trying to organize a national poor people's campaign to mobilize poor people to go to Washington and have a lobby in and camp in and set at the nation's capital until something was done about poverty. And so King was traveling around the country like a demon, really, speaking here, speaking there, sleeping 4 hours a night, constantly on the go, crisscrossing back and forth across the country. And his advisors, particularly Andrew Young, said, you know, you can't do one more thing. You're just about at a breaking point. And so they didn't want him to go to Memphis, mainly because King had done this numerous times in the past where he stopped in to help a movement that was already underway and then became involved in the movement and sucked into it and ended up in jail. And this happened to him in Albany, Georgia, for instance, where he went without even a toothbrush, just expecting to make a speech. And the next thing he knew, he was practically leading the movement, spent many days in jail there. And that's what they were afraid would happen when he went down to Memphis. And of course, that is what happened. Once he went there and made a speech on March 18th, he got thoroughly involved in the movement and had to go back again. And the second time he went back, he was assassinated.
Now, one of the things that continues to be mythologized, and it's not that, of course, King wasn't a great advocate of nonviolence, but he was used almost as an icon for nonviolence in a way to almost distract from his radical vision that something was fundamentally wrong with capitalism. And I was hoping, and your book does it beautifully, that you could begin to talk about King in that context as the critique of capitalism, as the advent of black power was developing as well. What were his relationships to those issues and his understanding and participation in those concerns?
Well, there's a section in the book where King is brought down to Memphis earlier in 1966 in the summer. King's busily trying to mount a campaign against racism and economic injustice in Chicago. And in the middle of that, James Meredith starts a march against fear in Mississippi and gets shot down in Mississippi. And King immediately flies to Memphis and takes up the march where Meredith left off. And during that, they lead a march through the state. And Stokely Carmichael from SNCC is one leader and King from SCLC is the other. And there they have a big debate about black power versus integration, self-defense versus nonviolence. And the different people who participated in that movement in Mississippi note that King was made an icon, as you say, for nonviolence. But he always worked closely with Stokely Carmichael. And even though they had different views about how to go forward, he never backed away from working with Stokely or any of the other people that were considered more, quote, radical than King. And in fact, King, in his analysis of what was going on in America at the time, was just as radical as anybody. He said that racism, poverty, and war were all intertwined, and that U.S. imperialism in Southeast Asia in particular was leading the country down the road to ruin, and that you could never really deal with poverty in America and with racism in America until the military stopped sucking up all of the resources and sending people off to war. So the things that he talked about, he said the movement is forcing America to face all its interrelated flaws of racism, poverty, militarism, and materialism. It's exposing evils that are deeply rooted in the whole structure of our society. Radical reconstruction of society itself is the real issue to be faced. He said that in a speech against the Vietnam War on April 4th, 1967. And clearly, King was talking about really transforming the society in fundamental ways.
He also said something is wrong with capitalism as it now stands in the United States. We're not interested in being integrated into this value structure, and talked about a radical redistribution of the power that must take place. This is about as dramatic and as radical as you can get.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, James Lawson, who's one of the great people in this book, says that it's always been easy for people to typecast King as sort of a narrowly defined civil rights leader, whereas in fact King was a minister and a person concerned with moral issues and who was deeply rooted in the church and never confined his concerns simply to civil rights for African Americans, as important as that was. He was talking about trying to create a different kind of society, and the way he analyzed it was the civil rights movement as we normally think of it, from 1955 to 65, from Montgomery to Selma, was really the first phase. And once we got civil rights and equal rights in the law and voting rights, then that was the start to really transforming society, because without having power, African Americans could not play a role in doing that very well. And so once the South was freed of Jim Crow, his idea was to then free the country of racism and poverty and what he called extreme materialism, the things we're still struggling with today.
Where do you see going down Jericho Road, the Memphis strike, Martin Luther King's last campaign, in terms of its substance and significance today for those very real live struggles that continue?
Well, I think that what that history shows from 1968 is that it's very important to organize a community labor coalition, and that, as you mentioned at the beginning, the intersection of race, gender, and class issues is very important to doing that. And in Memphis, they were able to draw in the black clergy, the black students, white faculty members, black faculty members, unionists, really the kind of coalition that King was always talking about building. And women, of course, were central to this. Although the strike was black men, women were leading the boycotts of the shopping downtown. And King always had the idea of building coalitions. And doing it through a strike or through union organizing is really difficult indeed to pull off. And they did in 1968. And they eventually won, despite Dr. King's death. And it's an example of kind of the high point of the 1960s freedom movement, shifting from civil rights issues into economic issues and building the kind of coalitions that can bring about real change. So I think it's a good example for us to know about, and one that has been not completely ignored, but mostly not really understood. And other movements that King was involved in have gotten a lot of scholarly attention, and this one had not. So it's something really worth knowing about.
That's what I found so profound. We certainly are aware of the tremendous work of Taylor Branch. But this book, which focused on this last campaign, particularly of King, and as I said, that melding of working class ideology and necessity for a transformative state of society with the civil rights movement, I think you detail brilliantly. And I really, really would advocate for people who want to know not only about the historical imperative, but the current reality of how we organize. Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign by Professor Michael Honey is a must reading. What do you think? What was the most striking kind of incentive or inspiration to put this book together, Mike?
Well, I was in Memphis myself as an organizer from 1970 to 76, and I worked on the Poor People's Campaign when I was in college in 1968, and I thought that this was a part of the movement history that had sort of gotten lost somewhere, and that I've been, for the last 25 years, really researching the history of the CIO unions in the South in the 1930s and 40s, black workers organizing in unions from the 1920s through the 1990s. So this became the third part of a trilogy of books on labor and civil rights in the South, and the inspiration for it really was the workers themselves, as well as Dr. King, and what they were able to accomplish under very, very difficult circumstances.
And we've been speaking with Professor Mike Honey, Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.